My father continued to tear through the office. He began to pull books off a nearby shelf one at a time, then suddenly raked the remaining ones off with his arm in frustration. It'll be concealed behind an armored access panel, like a safe. Any ideas? I shook my head. We don't have a safe, I said. We never needed one. I held up my QCOM, but I've got Ray's number. Be careful what you say, he warned. Vance could be monitoring your QCOM. Not anymore, I told him. After Vance broke in on my conference call with the Armistice Council, Lex helped me turn on my QCOM's hidden security mode, the same feature that Vance uses to prevent his own QCOM from being monitored. Captain Larkin appears to be something of a genius, doesn't she? I caught him studying my face for a reaction and blushed involuntarily. I nodded in reply, then pulled up my contacts and tapped the last name listed there. Ray Habishaw. His face instantly appeared on my display. His name, rank, and current location appeared across the bottom. He was at an EDA base in Arizona called Gila Mountain. Zach! He shouted. Where are you? Are you okay? He lowered his voice and moved his QCOM camera a bit too close to his mouth. I heard you and your father went missing in action after you took out the disruptor. I was afraid you bought it. I shook my head and tilted my QCOM so that he could see my current location. You're back at the store? He said, brightening first, then scowling at the side of his office. What the hell, man? Who are you letting ransack the place, looters? I shook my head, then positioned the QCOM so that Ray could see my father, too. His eyes widened. General Lightman, he said, awkwardly saluting his QCOM. It's an honor, sir. My father returned the salute. The honor's all mine, Sergeant, he said. I owe you a huge debt for watching over my boy while I was gone. Thank you. You're welcome, he said, blushing visibly. Ray, we don't have much time, I said. We need to access the EDA intranet node hidden here in the store. It's an emergency. Ray only hesitated for a split second. Behind the UFO poster on the back wall. I turned and located the one he was talking about, a framed reprint of Mulder's I Want to Believe poster from the X-Files. I took it down, revealing what appeared to be a small titanium safe embedded in the brick wall behind it, with a keypad in its center. The combination is 11382112, Ray said. My father grinned and punched in the numbers. The lock disengaged, and he opened the door. The only thing behind it was a row of 10 Ethernet cable ports, just like those on the back of our cable router at home. Thank you, my father said. He turned to me. You guys got RJ45 cable here? I nodded. On the wall opposite the register. He ran out, and I looked back at Ray on my QCOM. Thanks, Ray, I said. But now I have to ask you for another favor, a big one. You better make it quick, pal, he said. The second wave is minutes away. I gave him the short version of the story. It still took way too long. Thankfully, Ray took even less convincing than Lex or my other friends. Once I finished telling him everything my father had told me, he paused for a few moments, then nodded. Tell me what you need, he said. As soon as we got our makeshift drone controller rigs connected to the hardline intranet node back in Ray's office, my father laid out the plan. Cruz, Deal, my mother, and I all watched my father's chalk talk there in the store, while Lex, Wodey, and Debbie listened over their QCOMs. I wasn't a fan of several aspects of his plan, but there was no time to argue or to come up with another solution. My father wished everyone good luck. Then the others stayed inside, while my mother and I walked outside to bid him farewell. What if you can't delay the icebreaker long enough for me to get there? I asked, once we were far enough outside that my friends wouldn't hear his answer. Don't worry, he said. I'll take care of it, okay? Okay. He grabbed me and pulled me into a fierce embrace. I love you, son, he said. Thank you for helping me do this. Thank you for believing in me. You'll never know how much that means. He kissed my forehead, then walked over to say goodbye to my mother. She wasn't crying. She'd put on her bravest face for both of us. They spoke to each other briefly, but I stayed out of earshot. I don't know what they said to each other. But my mother nodded before she kissed him goodbye, and he smiled at her. Then he turned and climbed inside my damaged interceptor and my mother and I watched as he flew off, bound for the Raven Rock Command Center. After his ship had vanished over the horizon in a blur, we continued to stare up at the sky for a few more fearful moments, dreading what we knew would soon descend from it. Then we ran back inside the store and prepared to carry out our own part of the mission. 25. The second wave arrived just minutes after my father departed, and a swarm of Glaive and Wyvern fighters descended from the sky to attack Portland and the surrounding suburbs. Our drone reserves were heavily diminished, and consequently we were far more outnumbered than we had been during the first wave. But the EDA's civilian gamer forces continued to put up a valiant fight, and a fierce battle raged in the streets of the city and in the sky above while we carried out our mission inside the store. During his chalk talk, my father had explained how the EDA's hardline intranet worked. It was an underground fiber-optic cable network directly linking all of its drone controller outposts together, creating a disruptor-proof communication system that the Alliance had prepared in anticipation of the invasion. It would allow the EDA to keep communications open between its command outposts and allow drone operators to help defend other installations remotely while the disruptor was active via hardwired defense turrets and tethered drones. If everything went according to my father's plan, we would be able to use our intranet connection at Starbase Ace to help him infiltrate the Raven Rock outpost during the chaos of the disruptor attack. If not, well, then he was going to be totally hosed. While my father piloted his manned interceptor to assault Raven Rock, where Vance's team was located, I sat inside Starbase Ace, piloting the three interceptors my father had commandeered from the Icarus crater and sent off toward massive Jupiter, its tiny moon, Europa, and the icebreaker closing in on it. Cruz and Deal took control of four new Aethids from a nearby EDA drone cache and redeployed them in the Starbase Ace parking lot to defend us during the second wave of the attack. Lex was at Sapphire Station, and Ray was at Gila Mountain. Both were connected to the hardline EDA intranet from inside their assigned drone controller pods, and both were already preparing to help my father execute his infiltration plan. While Cruz and Deal used their giant robots to help defend Starbase Ace from the incoming swarm of spider fighters and basilisks, my mother, Debbie, and Wodey all used Wasp aerial drone quadcopters to defend the store from above. Wodey was fighting from an Armada sit-down arcade game located in the game room of her Uncle Franklin's bowling alley in New Orleans. Debbie was back home in Duluth, controlling her drone from her own living room, while her three sons continued to stand guard outside their home by controlling EDA drones with an Xbox, a laptop, and a touchscreen tablet, respectively. We knew that Debbie and Wodey would both lose control of their drones when the disruptor switched on, but there was nothing we could do about that. They intended to help out for as long as they could. While my friends kept the enemy drones at bay, I continued to pilot my drones toward Jupiter, trying to make it to Europa in time to stop the icebreaker, while my father attempted to prevent Vance from launching the weapon before my ships even got there. That was when we got word via a public EDA command broadcast that the second disruptor was about to make landfall back here on Earth, in the unlikeliest of locations. At first, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Instead of activating the disruptor in a secluded spot like Antarctica, this time the aliens picked a far less subtle location, the National Monument at Devil's Tower, Wyoming, the same spot where humanity makes first contact with the alien visitors in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, an intergalactic game of Simon, featuring those same five tones the Europans had used to bookend their cryptic transmissions to us. "Oh, that's not cool," Deal shouted, staring at a live video image of the disruptor taken by an orbiting satellite. "Are these alien pricks openly mocking us now? Christ!" When the disruptor activated, the drones my friends were using to defend Starbase Ace were disabled and went limp or fell out of the sky, as did every untethered EDA drone around the world. But the European drones continued to attack, closing in on Starbase Ace as if they somehow knew it was of strategic importance. Lex, Ray, Debbie, and Wodey all lost control of their drones as their links went dead, So did Cruz and Deal, but they both ran outside and activated the hardline controllers on two dormant Aethids. They detached the small Xbox-like game controller from each Aethid's back and then ran back inside, unspooling their drone's carbon-fiber-sheathed tether cables to their maximum length. My mother, always cool during a crisis, ran over to guard the door behind me with an aluminum baseball bat, apparently with the intention of using it to fight off any killer alien robots that attempted to get past her. I took off my Q-com, strapped it onto her right wrist, and showed her how to fire its built-in laser. She tossed her bat aside, then aimed the device at the floor and activated its beam for a split second, long enough to burn a hole in the carpet and the concrete foundation beneath. "I got this," she said, smiling with satisfaction. Then she aimed her new weapon back at the door, continuing to stand guard over me. I focused my attention back on the array of monitors and controllers spread out around me. The three interceptors my father had launched from the Icarus crater were finally closing in on Europa. Even though I was located inside the disruptor's cancellation field, these three ships were millions of miles outside of it, so my quantum communication link to them was unaffected. And so, unfortunately, were the EDA's links to the icebreaker and its fighter escort, under the control of Vance and his underlings at Raven Rock. I took control of the lead interceptor, and through its cameras, I could see the icebreaker closing in on the icy moon, surrounded by its escort of 24 drone interceptors. I knew that those ships were under the control of the best pilots the EDA had available, and that would almost certainly include Viper and Rostam, who were both listed above me in the Armada pilot rankings for a very good reason. They were better than me. Even with three ships, there was no way I could take them all on at once, no matter how badly I wanted to. So instead, I did as my father had instructed. I sat tight, out of sight, and waited for him to even the odds. When he reached Raven Rock, my father circled high over the base, waiting until the moment the enemy activated the disruptor. He knew exactly when it happened because the EDA fighters and drones protecting the installation down below deactivated instantaneously. I also lost the audio and video feeds from inside his cockpit, but a few seconds later, Lex executed some further computer wizardry and a live video image of my father's ship reappeared at the edge of my HUD. The feed appeared to be from one of the base's external security cameras, fed back to us through the hardline intranet. With the base's defenses momentarily disabled, my father had turned his interceptor into a steep dive, and now he appeared to be making a suicide run at the base's armored blast doors, which were still very much closed. As he raced toward the base, I realized he was aiming for one of the drone launch tunnels, just as I had earlier during my colossal screw-up at Crystal Palace. But here, instead of being disguised as grain silos, the launch tunnel openings were camouflaged as rock formations embedded in the mountainside. I sat in Starbase Ace, watching his progress over the base's network of security cameras. Once his ship was inside the Raven Rock drone hangar, my father set it to hover on autopilot, then used his ship's laser turret to cut a large hole in the ceiling. He raised his interceptor up to the opening, opened his cockpit canopy, and jumped out, scrambling into the dust-filled level above the hangar ceiling. Then he drew his sidearm and took off running, even deeper into the base. I expected the corridors to be empty or filled with inert drones, but when the disruptor activated, some of the base's internal hardwired defense turrets had remained operational, along with a few dozen tethered Aethids, all controlled by operators linked to them through the EDA's hardline intranet. They were already converging on my father's position, under orders to stop him at all costs. If it hadn't been for Lex and Ray, he wouldn't have had a chance. Thankfully, Lex was already inside the EDA's security firewall, so she was able to access the base security system to guide my father and use it to help him avoid or evade as many of the tethered Aethids as she could while throwing up blast doors around his route to keep defenders away. Meanwhile, Ray used his own hardline network access to seize control of the laser defense turrets positioned along my dad's route and used them to blast a path through the drone stationed ahead of him. But just when there seemed to be no stopping him, they stopped him. His luck ran out and a pack of tethered Aethids got the jump on him. He managed to take them all out, but not before a stray plasma bolt hit him in the chest, and he went down. I watched helplessly as he struggled to get back on his feet, but he couldn't. So He began to crawl. He pulled himself down the corridor until he reached a charging dock where 5 dormant Aethids were stored. He opened up the maintenance access panels one at a time and entered a long code on each one, then all 4 of them powered up. My father detached the tethered controllers from each drone and used them to command the 4 Aethids to lift his injured body off the ground. Then he had them interlace their 8 arms and legs around his body, forming something that looked sort of like a walking spider tank. This contraption lifted him up and continued to carry him forward. He rode inside as he blasted his way farther into the base, firing 4 sets of Aethid weapons as he came. He also hijacked all of their external speakers and then used them to play a song I recognized immediately from his old Raid the Arcade mix, Run's House by Run-DMC. "Archie really hates hip-hop," we heard him say. "I bet this will throw him off balance, like Ride of the Valkyries." He cranked the song up to an ear-splitting volume. I could see him mouthing the lyrics as he continued to fight his way toward Vance, lumbering forward like a Terminator that was never going to stop until it had completed its final mission. My father piloted his makeshift tank down one last corridor, then finally arrived at his destination. A pair of armored doors labeled Raven Rock Drone Operations Command Center. Then, to my horror, I watched as he set the power cells on all 4 of his Aethids to manual overload. In a panic, I asked Lex to patch my voice through to him. "I already did," she said. "He can hear you right now." "Dad, what are you doing?" I screamed, but it was a rhetorical question. I knew exactly what he was doing. He glanced up at the security camera mounted nearby, the one we were watching him on. He smiled, but he didn't answer me. He just turned his makeshift spider tank around and then used it to crash through the armored doors into the command center itself. Several of the drone drivers had already climbed out of their pods and were now standing there in the middle of the room waiting for him, including one I recognized, Captain Dog, a.k.a. Rostam, the teenage officer who had asked for my autograph. He looked completely starstruck in my father's presence. Admiral Vance was standing in their midst, waiting, too. The admiral ordered his men to open fire on my father as soon as he stumbled forward into the room, but only a few of them actually obeyed. The majority of them, including Rostam, didn't even raise their weapons, and most of those who did couldn't seem to bring themselves to fire, not with General Xavier Lightman in their sights. Then Vance started shooting, firing his 9mm Beretta. First, he took out the speakers on each of my father's drones, silencing the music blaring out of them. Then he turned his weapon on my father. I saw Rostam avert his gaze. "You're a damn fool," Vance said, just before he opened fire on my father. Several of his men opened fire, too. Most of their shots were deflected by his shield of Aethids, but not all of them. A bullet grazed my father's left leg. He still didn't stop coming, though. He continued to lurch forward, piloting his makeshift Aethid spider tank farther into the room as more laser fire and bullets struck him and his drones until he finally collapsed a few yards away from Admiral Vance, trapped inside the tangled wreckage of the 4 Aethids. That was when Vance finally spotted the power core overload countdowns ticking away on each of them. All of them had about 10 seconds remaining. "You guys all need to get out of here," my father said. Rostam and the other men turned and ran for the exit as fast as their legs would carry them, but Vance didn't move. "You better get going too, Archie," my father said. 6 seconds. 5. Vance shook his head and then ran to the exit before turning back. "This was pointless," he said. "This won't stop us from deploying the icebreaker, you know." Then he turned and ran, and the op center doors hissed closed behind him. "I know," I heard my father mutter to himself. "I was just trying to delay you." Then he laughed. "My son is going to stop you." Then my father's 4 makeshift bombs all detonated in unison, and the video feed went black. I screamed. I don't know for how long. When I finally got a hold of myself and returned to my senses, I checked the camera feeds from my 3 drones orbiting Europa. The squadron of EDA drones escorting the icebreaker had broken formation. They were now drifting around the icebreaker, which had discontinued its descent toward the moon. At this very moment, I knew Admiral Vance and the other pilots who had been in control of the icebreaker's fighter escort were evacuating the Raven Rock installation, but I also knew that it would only be a matter of seconds before they reached a safe location and retook control of their drones and the icebreaker. I probably had less than a minute before they started to come back online. I left two interceptors orbiting at a distance, took control of the third, and swooped in to attack the defenseless drones drifting helplessly in front of me. I destroyed half of the icebreaker's fighter escort before I came to my senses and forgot about the rest to focus all of my fire on destroying the icebreaker. But I was still struggling to knock out its shields when Vance and his men seized control of their drones once again from some new location, possibly using their QCOMs. Suddenly I found myself outnumbered and outgunned, locked into a dogfight with six interceptors. As I moved to engage, the song One Vision by Queen queued up on my father's old Raid the Arcade playlist. That finally managed to put me in the zone. I took out four of their ships in as many seconds, leaving only two interceptors remaining, the ones piloted by Rostam and Viper Vance. I went after Rostam first, recklessly ramming his drone with mine. The impact set his drone careening off at an oblique angle right into the path of one of the icebreaker's automated sentry guns. It exploded in a collapsing fireball. Now, it was just me and Admiral Vance. The two of us were now locked in a fierce duel around the icebreaker as it hovered above Europa. Muffled through my headphones, I could hear the chaotic sounds of real-world combat somewhere close by, and they were growing ever closer. Spider fighters had surrounded Starbase Ace. Cruz, Deal, and my mother were fighting to keep them at bay, and a basilisk was closing in on the store. Then, at the last minute, Wodey swooped down out of the sky in her own manned interceptor. When the disruptor had activated and she'd lost control of her drone, she decided to jump back into her prototype interceptor and had hauled ass here from New Orleans to help us. She took out the basilisk on her first pass with a shot right between the eyes, then swung around again and strafed the spider fighters, allowing me to focus my attention back on my duel with Admiral Vance halfway across the solar system. I knew that Vance had flown on my father's wing at Moonbase Alpha, but he turned out to be even better than I expected. Before I knew what had happened, Vance had swung around on my tail and blasted my interceptor to pieces. Then he turned and continued to escort the icebreaker to its target. But Vance didn't know that I still had those last two interceptors in reserve, waiting in a holding pattern nearby. I took control of another ship and went after Vance. I managed to strafe him with a barrage of plasma bolts, but his shields held and his ship remained undamaged. He killed me again. He was really good. Almost as good as my father, but not quite. I took control of my last ship and once again intercepted Vance and the icebreaker just as it came within firing range of Europa's surface. It was now or never. I pushed aside my grief and paralyzing rage and focused on what I wanted now more than anything else in this life, to make my father proud of me and to make certain that his sacrifice had not been in vain. I firewalled my interceptor's throttle and locked horns with Vance's drone, which was still flying in a protective pattern around the icebreaker. But his ship's power core was running low now, while I had a fresh ship with a full charge. There was no time now for subtlety. I put my fighter into a dive and came straight at him with all guns blazing while he did the same, the two of us playing an outer space variation on a game of chicken, unloading all of our weapons at one another simultaneously. A split second before we collided, his depleted shields failed, but mine held, allowing me to destroy his ship with a well-placed plasma bolt. It incinerated his ship, just as mine flew straight through the ensuing fireball. I didn't stop to celebrate. I swooped down to take out the icebreaker, too, just seconds before it launched its nukes at Europa's surface. "Don't do it, kid!" Vance screamed over the comlink channel, now powerless to stop me. "If you do this, you'll be personally responsible for the extinction of the entire human race." I went ahead and did it anyway. When I fired a last burst from my sun guns, the icebreaker went up in a brilliant, soundless explosion of light. 26. That was all it took. In that one moment, it appeared that I had negotiated a ceasefire. The news was already coming in over all of the EDA comlink channels. All around the world, the alien drones and ships had just suddenly deactivated, allowing themselves to be easily destroyed. I sat there listening to the news the war was over, trying to make myself believe it. Then, just as I was about to disengage from my interceptor and remove my helmet, I saw the surface of Europa crack open beneath me, breaking apart like an eggshell as a giant chrome orb rose out of the hidden ocean below, ripping a massive circular hole in the surface ice as it zoomed up into orbit and began to hover in space directly in front of my ship. Upon closer inspection, I saw that the object was actually an icosahedron with 20 symmetrical faceted sides, a 20-sider, Shin would have probably called it. The icosahedron hovered in front of my ship. Then it began to speak to me.
"I am the emissary," it said. "I am an intelligent machine created by a galactic community of peaceful civilizations known as the Sodality."
The emissary quickly explained to me that there were never actually any extraterrestrial beings living on Europa at all. Only microbial life had evolved in the moon's subsurface ocean. No intelligent beings, indigenous or otherwise, had ever lived there. "Then who built the armada that just attacked Earth?" I asked. I felt like a character in someone else's dream. "Who have we been fighting this entire time?"
"I built the armada," it said. "And this entire time, you were fighting against yourselves. The Sodality has been monitoring your species' radio and television broadcasts for as long as you've been transmitting them into space. But we didn't begin to take a special interest in humanity until 1945, when you created your first nuclear weapon and then used it for warfare against your own kind. At that time, we used all of that data we had collected to create a detailed profile of your species and ascertain its evolutionary strengths and weaknesses. In 1969, when your species became technologically advanced enough to reach another world, in this case, your own moon, you became a potential threat to the other members of the Sodality. And that was when I was sent here, to deliver the test."
"So it was a test after all," I said. "What for?"
"A test that we use to gauge whether or not your species is capable of existing peacefully within the Sodality,"
the emissary said.
"It was initiated when your probe first discovered the swastika on Europa's surface. We selected a symbol that your culture most associates with war and death, and then we recreated an enormous replica of that symbol on the nearest celestial body in your solar system, with conditions capable of harboring intelligent life. We knew your discovery of such a symbol would eventually prompt you to send another probe down to the surface to investigate its origin,"
the emissary said.
"As soon as your probe landed on Europa, the next phase of the test began. I simulated a standard first contact scenario for your species, in which a cultural misunderstanding leads to a declaration of war."
The machine's declaration didn't ring true to my ears, but I was in no mental condition to start a debate. You built all those drones yourself? I said. And you controlled them in combat?
Affirmative.
So, this entire time it was just you, I said. One artificially intelligent supercomputer pretending to be a hostile alien race for the purpose of testing humanity's character?
In very simple terms, yes, that is accurate.
The machine paused.
It was your time to be tested. The Sodality found it necessary to ascertain how your species would handle a common first contact scenario with a neighboring civilization. As I said, it was a test. The test.
Your test killed millions of innocent people, I said through clenched teeth, including several of my friends and my father.
We are sorry for the losses you have suffered, the emissary said. But know that many other species have passed the test with no conflict or loss of life.
I was nearly sobbing now. What did you want us to do? What were we supposed to do?
There is no right or wrong way of taking the test, the emissary told me. Using human psychological terms, it was a projective test rather than an objective one. It presents the subject civilization with varying sets of circumstances intended to gauge your capacity for empathy and altruism, and your ability to act and negotiate as one collective species. It allows the Sodality to see how your species navigates first contact with a species of similar temperament.
Isn't there an easier way to do that? I asked. One that wouldn't have involved killing millions of us and trashing our whole planet?
The test reveals things about a species that cannot be ascertained any other way. What your Earth scientists refer to as an emergent property.
I didn't know how to respond. I was almost too upset to form thoughts or words.
You should not feel too remorseful about how the test played out, the machine said. Your species' primitive, warlike nature made a certain amount of conflict inevitable, as it often does. Regardless, your species should be pleased with the outcome. You passed the test.
We did?
Yes. The result was uncertain for a while, but you did well at the end. Many species lack the ability to defy their own animal instincts and allow their intellect to prevail. Such species are usually declared unfit for survival, much less membership in the Sodality.
So you're saying that if I hadn't destroyed the icebreaker, you would have exterminated the entire human race?
Correct, the machine replied. But, thankfully, you made the correct choice and knowingly disengaged from the cycle of warlike escalation with your imaginary enemy. That is why I am speaking to you now. Once the test has been passed, the emissary makes contact with the individual most directly responsible to inform them that their species has been invited to join the Sodality.
How many other civilizations are there in the Sodality?
At present, The Sodality has 8 members, it replied. Your species will be the 9th if you accept our invitation.
How do we do that?
You may accept the invitation on your species' behalf right now, it told me. You have earned that right.
What if we decline to join?
No species has ever declined to join the Sodality, the emissary told me. There are many benefits to membership. The sharing of knowledge, medicine and technology, among other things. Your species' longevity and individual quality of life will increase drastically.
I didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking it over. I just went ahead and said yes.
Congratulations.
That's it?
Yes, that is it.
What happens now?
Now we will begin the process of inducting your species into the Sodality, it said. The first step is for us to share certain beneficial aspects of our technology with your species that will help you rebuild your civilization. Very soon your people will also be free from sickness and hunger. But this is just the first step. The Sodality will contact you again when you are ready for the next one.
When will that be?
It depends on what you do with what you are given.
Before I could sort out my next question, the emissary probe departed, warping out of our solar system in a blink. I never saw it again. I parked my interceptor in orbit around Europa and disengaged the link, leaving it there, possibly forever. Then I turned around and saw my mom standing behind me, along with Cruz and Deal. All 3 of them had been watching, and I saw that Cruz and Deal had both recorded my entire conversation with the emissary on their phones. I asked Deal to post my exchange with the emissary on the internet, but he told me there was no need. The aliens had been broadcasting it all around the world, on every TV channel and device connected to the internet. The truth about the emissary and existence of the Sodality had already been revealed to the entire human race. When the 3rd wave of the alien armada arrived a few hours later, the drones didn't attack. Instead, they landed and began to help humanity rebuild its civilization, as well as its planet's fragile environment. The alien drones also began to dispense miraculous life-giving medicine and technology, along with an endless supply of clean, abundant energy. It seemed like they gave humanity everything it had ever wanted. But while the world celebrated its victory, all my mother and I could do was go back home and begin the process of mourning everything we'd just lost. Epilogue. My friends and I each received a Medal of Honor from the President on the lawn in front of the newly rebuilt White House in Washington, D.C. And my mom thought it was just as hysterical as I did when they decided to rename the gym I'd destroyed at my high school after me. As promised, Lex took me out on our first date, but we spent most of it in a state of traumatized disbelief, talking over everything that had just happened to us. It wasn't until our 4th or 5th date that we were able to focus on something other than the invasion. Then we did our best to stop discussing it altogether. With Ray's blessing, I decided to take over the operation of Starbase Ace. Lex moved to town with her grandmother, and they both helped me run the place. It quickly became the most popular second-hand video game store / historical battlefield in the world. On the 1-year anniversary of his death, a commemorative statue of my father was erected in the Beaverton Town Square, and we all attended the unveiling ceremony, during which my father was posthumously awarded military honors and medals from dozens of different nations. Admiral Vance gave the closing address, during which he spoke at length about my father's bravery and their long friendship. He spoke honestly, as he always had, about how my father had prevented him from making the worst mistake of his career. His shame and regret were evident, even though he was far from being the only political or military leader guilty of the same mistake. My dad had been right about Admiral Vance. He was a good man. Afterward, as we were admiring my father's statue, something strange happened. A young man stopped me to ask for an autograph. That, in itself, wasn't a strange occurrence at all, now that the sodality had made me an international celebrity. What was strange was that this particular young man happened to be Douglas Notcher, my old high school nemesis. He was wearing an EDA uniform with the rank of sergeant. He was also standing on a pair of artificial legs, which were heavily in fashion this year. His right arm was a robotic replacement, too. For a moment, I almost didn't recognize him. His self-satisfied smirk was long gone. He held out a pen, along with a copy of our senior yearbook open to my photo. Because of the war, our class had never even had a proper graduation ceremony. They had mailed us our diplomas along with our yearbooks. I took the yearbook and scrawled my name beneath my photo. Then I paused a moment to study the clueless, smiling teenager in the picture. For a moment, I almost didn't recognize him either. I handed the book back to him. He tucked it under his lone arm. "I was sorry to hear about your father," I told him. He glanced at his shoes and nodded. "Wish I could say the same," he muttered. "The world is a better place without him." He gave me a sad smile, then motioned to the statue of my father, looming over both of us. "You must be really proud of him." I nodded. "I am." "If he was here now, I'm sure he'd be proud of you, too," he said. I opened my mouth to respond, but no words came out. Notcher had obviously done a lot of growing up, maybe even more than I had. I wondered if he'd heard about Casey, the boy he'd bullied mercilessly throughout most of high school. He'd died during the first wave, along with his whole family and millions of others. I decided to not bring Casey up. I'm sure he knew. We stood there in silence for another moment, staring at my father's statue. Then Notcher turned to go. But first, he offered me his left hand, the real one. I reached out with my own left hand to shake it. Then, without another word, he turned and walked off into the crowd. I never saw him again. After the ceremony, the four of us went to visit my father's grave. Me, Lex, my mom, and my three-month-old baby brother, little Xavier Ulysses Lightman Jr., the kid whose name ensured that he would never have to pay for a drink as long as he lived. We'd visited my father's tombstone many times, of course. But his empty casket had been exhumed a few months after he died, and we'd had another funeral for him. And this time, we'd filled his casket with old mementos before they buried it again. I'd put a few of his old mixtapes in there. I'd thought about burying his old high score jacket with him, but then decided that I should keep it to give to my little brother. He must have sensed this, too, because whenever I wore the jacket, like I did today, Xavier Jr. was constantly reaching out to grab hold of its patches, then would refuse to let go. "No, J.R.," I would tell him. He seemed to prefer these initials over Junior. "Mine. You can have it when you're big enough to wear it, little man." And then he would gurgle happily back at me. When we reached my father's gravesite, we discovered the ground around it piled high with flowers, notes, and gifts from well-wishers around the world, as usual. My mother added her hand-picked bouquet to the pile. Then we stood there in silence for a while, admiring the sunset and paying our respects. When we finally bid my father farewell and turned to go, I paused to admire the inscription on his new headstone, which I'd had a hand in writing. "Here lies Xavier Ulysses Lightman, 1980 to 2018. Beloved husband, father, and son. He saved humanity from total annihilation. You're welcome." I stood there, staring at his headstone, thinking over everything that had happened over the past year. Soon after the war ended, I'd received an offer from the EDA to take on an ambassadorial role to the Sodality, but I'd turned it down. I wasn't interested in helping either the asshole aliens who devised such a horrible test and murdered my father, or the human powers that be who had lied to all of humanity for decades and nearly brought us to extinction. As the emissary had promised, things on Earth were changing for the better, thanks to the Sodality's advanced technology and medicine. My mom had to find a new nursing job for the best possible reason. We now had a cure for all forms of cancer, which had eradicated the disease in a matter of weeks, and most other diseases, too. The Sodality had also gifted us a new form of cheap, clean fusion energy technology. It looked as if humanity had begun a new age of wonders and miracles. Perhaps it was my late father's influence, but despite all of their generous gifts, I still felt mistrustful of the Sodality. In hindsight, their tests seemed like more of a trap, when they had set and baited for all of humanity. How benevolent could the beings behind such immoral machinations really be? Yes, they had shared all of these technological advances with humanity, but they still hadn't revealed any real details about themselves, or the different alien species they claimed made up the Sodality, always using the excuse that humanity wasn't ready for that knowledge yet, and that it was beyond our primitive understanding. Whenever I read about this in the news, I heard the echo of my father's words, "This human understands enough to know when he's being messed with." Now, I couldn't shake that same suspicion. They had messed with us, and they clearly weren't finished messing with us. How long would their generosity last? What would happen if and when it ended? I looked over at my loved ones, Lex, my mother, and little Xavier Jr. I wondered what sort of world he was going to grow up in, what sort of world we were going to allow the Sodality to impose on us. That was the moment when I realized I couldn't stay at Starbase Ace. There was no going back to the life I'd had before, because it was gone for everyone, along with the world in which we'd lived it. I couldn't just sit on the sidelines and remain disengaged from the world. Not after everything that had happened, and everything that might be in store for humanity. When I got back home that evening, I took out my QCOM and dialed my friend, Dr. Shostak. I told him I had decided to become one of Earth's ambassadors to the Sodality after all. In time, I hoped my new job would eventually put me in a position to learn the truth about our new alien benefactor's true motives. For the time being, I intended to try to follow Master Yoda's timeless advice to keep my mind on where I was and what I was doing, and to do everything I could to protect what was now most important to me. It wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. After all of the things that had happened to me, after everything I'd been through, I no longer found myself staring out the window and daydreaming of adventure. Raid the Arcade Mix. 8889. Noise reduction? Hell no. Side A, track 1. One Vision, Queen. Track 2, Crazy Train, Ozzy. Track 3, Chase the Ace, AC/DC. Track 4, Hair of the Dog, Nazareth. Track 5, Get It On, Power Station. Track 6, Old Enough to Rock and Roll, Rainy Haynes. Track 7, Danger Zone, Kenny Loggins. Track 8, Vital Signs, Rush. Track 9, Barracuda, Heart. Track 10, TNT, AC/DC. Track 11, You Really Got Me, Van Halen. Track 12, Another One Bites the Dust, Queen. Track 13, One of These Days, Pink Floyd. Track 14, Top Gun Anthem, Harold Faltermeyer. Side B, track 1, I Hate Myself for Loving You, Joan Jett. Track 2, It Takes Two, Rob Bass. Track 3, Hammer to Fall, Queen. Track 4, Twilight Zone, Golden Earring. Track 5, We're Not Gonna Take It, Twisted Sister. Track 6, Rock You Like a Hurricane, Scorpions. Track 7, Black Betty, Ram Jam. Track 8, DT, AC/DC. Track 9, Delirious, ZZ Top. Track 10, Iron Eagle, King Cobra. Track 11, Run's House, Run DMC. Track 12, We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions, Queen. Bonus track, Snoopy versus the Red Baron, the Royal Guardsman. This is Will Wheaton. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Armada by Ernest Cline. This program was directed by Gabrielle DeCure. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2015 by Dark All Day, Inc. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.